We've been talking about the moon. We're going to be talking about the moon, then we're going to talk about the sun for a little bit. Notice that date. 8/21/2018. Last week, NASA made an announcement concerning the moon. It says on Tuesday, 8/21/18, NASA officials at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory confirmed the first definitive evidence of water on the surface of the moon, settling a decades-long debate about whether the substance was ice or simply hydrogen. They knew this substance was up there, but didn't really know exactly what it was. This discovery has wide-reaching implications for the future lunar settlements and exploratory missions, in addition to some unexpected results for lunar astronomers. So I wanted to bring this up because we're talking about the moon. I think it was last week we saw where Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin had stepped on the moon. As I said, next year will be 50 years since that happened. That's hard to believe, but it's been that long. But they're still learning new things about the moon. You know, we haven't learned everything. We're far from it. Scientists have previously suspected the presence of ice at the moon's poles, but the data could have also been explained by reflective properties of the soil. In contrast, the study identified several characteristic signatures that give concrete proof that the moon is host to a critical resource. And of course, that critical resource is water. Of course, anytime we leave the planet, we've got to take our environment with us. We've got to take our oxygen, and one of the things we have to take is also water. Water's heavy. It takes up a lot of room, a lot of space. We consume a lot of water. We use a lot of water. So if you've got to go to the moon and make a colony, we would have to be taking water shuttles up to the moon. But with this discovery, maybe if we colonize the moon, the water's already there. That's what they're thinking. Unlike previous detections of subsurface water on the moon, they had found, some of the probes that they've sent up there, evidence of water below the surface. But you remember, there's not any atmosphere on the moon. So they were beginning to wonder if all the water that had been on the surface had evaporated. But it looks like there is some still on the moon. The majority of the ice discovered resides on the surface of the moon, nestled in the shadows cast by craters near the poles. North and South Pole, the top and bottom of the moon. Sunlight never warms these areas, thanks to the minimal tilt of the moon's rotational axis and the frigid temperature of minus 250 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's frozen water. Whereas the lunar North Pole only has scattered patches of water, the South Pole boasts the majority. So most of the water that they have discovered is at the North or South Pole. North apparently doesn't have a lot. The South Pole has quite a bit. The other parts of the surface of the moon apparently doesn't have a lot of water. Here's a picture. I know it's kind of hard to see, but this is the North Pole, and there's just a few little blue spots here and there. On the South Pole, there's quite a bit. This is a close-up picture of it. Kind of shows you the lunar surface there on the left, and then under infrared light, they're able to see this. And like I said, they have known about this for a while, but apparently they've got enough data now that they are definitely saying that it is water. So they have discovered water on the moon. Yes.
If there's no atmosphere, water is made up of hydrogen, two parts of oxygen. For the hydrogen, the water gets formed.
Well, you know, if scientists would give you an answer, guess what their answer would probably be? Brought in by the meteors. You know, you look at the moon, it's full of meteor craters. There's also a theory that the water here on this Earth came about through meteors. You and I know that it was probably put there by who? God. Not probably, it was. It didn't come about in a meteor. If that's the case, where did the ice or water come from in the first place? You know, it just keeps going back and back and back. Something had to have a beginning somewhere. You know, God put it there when He created everything. It says, although this discovery may seem insignificant, there are potential impacts on the future of solar system exploration and settlement. NASA officials at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory suggested this discovery would enable humanity to explore and even stay on the moon. You know, that's been one of their goals, is to have a station, a place there on the moon that they can go to and take off and go from the moon up to other planets. Additionally, the existence of a water resource on the moon would also make future Mars missions more affordable and could fuel the first commercial enterprises that link Earth and the moon. So it could be in the near future that there may be people living on the moon, colonizing the moon, commercial exploration as far as minerals, mining. You know, it does have a lot of minerals that we could use here on Earth. Like I said, the biggest problem, again, has been one of the biggest problems is water. But if there's that much water on the moon, just on the surface, then that make it a little more feasible. So anyway, this just came about, like I said, last week, this announcement. So I just wanted to kind of bring that up since we've been talking about the moon, kind of get us up to date. How many people have looked at the sky the last few nights and noticed a bright star? It was by the moon. You're starting to separate now. I know Sunday night we got home and Janet went outside. She said, Bob, come out here. You never know what it could be, you know. So you walk out there and say, what? What is that? It was Mars. She said, well, I thought maybe it was some kind of a satellite or something. I said, nope, that's Mars. And then if you look over to the right, there's Jupiter. Fred and I was outside last night. Our house has a lot of pine trees growing around, so sometimes you don't get to see the horizon. You see patches of the sky here and there if you stand outside the house. But we were out there by the pole barn, and through this little group of trees, you can see Mars, and through this little group of trees, you can see Jupiter. Here's a picture that I got from the internet. This was at New Albany, Indiana, picture taken of their horizon. It's kind of hard to see, because they're not real bright. Of course, you know the moon. It's right there. This was taken on the 23rd, which would have been, what, last Thursday? Of course, the planets, they've kind of moved a little bit since then, but you might still be able to see them tonight. We don't have a lot of clouds. But this is Mars, that little dot right there is Mars. It's bright, kind of a reddish color, but it's been pretty obvious the last few days. This is Saturn. Now, you can't see it back there probably, a little dot right there. This is Antares, another dot right there. Antares is a sun, and we're going to talk about Antares here in a little while. It's a sun that's bigger than our sun. But it's so far away that we just see it as a little star. But it's up there. And then Jupiter. Whoops, that's not what I want to do. Go back here. Okay. Then Jupiter, right there, it was pretty bright last night. We could see that. And then Venus, we couldn't see, because again, like I said, you can't see the horizon from our place. But last Thursday, at Indiana, and probably most places, you could see four of the planets. And one sun. Of course, our moon also was up there. But it's kind of neat. We can see a lot of these planets that we've been talking about just with your naked eye. So if you had a telescope or something, you could really observe these planets and what's going on. This next slide, if we was pointing out, we saw this last week. This is our solar system. On the left-hand side, of course, is just a fraction of the sun, just to let you know where it is. Then you've got Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and of course Pluto's out there, and Pluto's no longer determined a planet, but that's where it's at, and that's about the size of it. But anyway, four of those planets that we've got, we could see up in the sky. Here's a size comparison. We looked at this too. There's the Earth. You can see that. Of course, Neptune and Uranus are about the same size. Saturn and Jupiter are the two biggest planets, Jupiter, of course, being the largest. And then you've got Venus, Mars, Mercury, and then they got a little dot down there called Pluto. So this kind of sets the stage for us to talk about the one thing we really haven't discussed too much, and that's the sun. So we'll spend a little bit of time tonight talking about our sun. Of course, without the sun, there'd be no life, as we know it anyway. You talked about the moon, where the sun doesn't shine. It's 240 degrees, minus 240 degrees Fahrenheit. It's cold. Neptune, as we mentioned, is minus 460 degrees. That's almost absolute zero. Can't get much colder than that. So our sun is a life force. We need it. It provides us with light. It provides us with warmth. And even with the sun, we mentioned that our average temperature here on this earth is 61 degrees. Of course, sometimes it gets hotter than that, sometimes it gets colder, but we're talking about the average around the whole globe. Of course, you've got the North Pole, South Pole, which is always cold, the equator, which is warm. So if you average all that out, we're still 61 degrees, even with this big old sun shining on us every day. Our sun is huge. You know, we just looked at the planets. We looked at how Earth compared to Jupiter, Jupiter being our largest planet. Let's look at the sun and see how it compares to Earth. You almost don't see Earth in that picture. There's Jupiter. It's the biggest planet we got, and it's dwarfed by our sun. We don't think of it as being that large because it's a long ways out there. But it is huge compared to Earth. Matter of fact, our sun is so big that it can hold 1.3 million Earths. 1,300,000 Earths. And the diameter is 863,706 miles, or 864,000 miles across diameter. How's that compared to Earth? Earth has a diameter of 7,926, or roughly 8,000 miles. So Earth is 8,000 miles across. Our sun is 864,000 miles across. Again, huge, big, big giant ball of fire in the sky. The moon's average distance from Earth is about 240,000 miles. So we kind of have an idea of how far it is from Earth to the moon. It's still a ways out there. But the sun is about 3.5 times the distance of the moon from the earth. So if the sun was touching the earth, it'd go out 3.5 times further than what the moon is. That's just how big that ball is. Huge. And again, it's kind of hard to comprehend all of that, but it just gives a little idea that it's big. It's huge. The sun is about 93 million miles from Earth. And its light takes about 8 minutes and 20 seconds to reach the Earth. How fast does light travel? 186,000 miles per second. Not an hour, per second. And again, to kind of give us an idea how far that is, how far is the moon on average? 240,000. So light travels 186,000 miles in a second. So the light that's reflected from the sun to the moon and back to Earth, that light from the moon to the Earth takes about 1.3 seconds to get here. So the moon's still a ways out there. Now we think of light traveling 186,000 miles a second. It's fast, and it is. But yet we talk about space, it's not that far, really. That's the reason when scientists use a distance measuring for space, they use what? Light years. the distance that light travels in a year. So if something is 4 light years from Earth, that means it would take light 4 years to get there at 186,000 miles per second. It's a long ways out there. But you couldn't measure it in miles because you couldn't write that number down. So light years is what they use for a measurement. The sun is made up of about 70% hydrogen, 28% helium, and 2% other gases. So our sun is a gas. There is no land. There is no solid on the sun. It's all gas. At the core of the sun, the temperature is about 27 million degrees Fahrenheit. Now, I want to know who went up there and measured that. And what kind of thermometer did they use? Of course, nobody's been there. They use mathematical equations as far as temperatures of gas and how they react and light frequencies. I mean, it's beyond me. But they have a pretty good idea that it's hot. 27 million degrees in the center of the sun. On the surface of the sun, it's only about 6,000 to 11,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So the surface is pretty cool, relatively speaking. Still not a place that we want to go to. It's hot. The sun produces its energy through a nuclear fusion reactions. Because of its own gravitational pressure, the hydrogen and helium nuclei are continually fusing together. And in the process, it releases enormous amounts of energy. So this hydrogen and helium that's up there is fusing. It takes four hydrogen atoms to fuse with one helium atom. And so there's a burst of light. There's a burst of energy when that happens. So that's what the sun is doing constantly, over and over again. It's a nuclear reactor. Every second, 1001, the sun is converting 700 million tons of hydrogen to about 695 million tons of helium, and therefore producing 5 million tons of energy. Again, how do you comprehend all that? Every second, 700 million tons of hydrogen being converted to 695 million tons of helium and produces 5 million tons of energy. Light and heat. That's less than 0.5% that's being produced in light and heat. But yet, how hot is the sun? That means the sun is constantly shrinking. It's burning itself up. The question is, how long is it going to last? Says, don't worry about it. Scientists say that at the rate the sun is burning up, it should last about 5 billion more years. So I don't think you and I have to worry about that. It's going to be there through our lifetime. So that's just, again, it gives you an idea how huge that thing is. If it's burning up at that rate, at 700 million tons a second, it's going to take another 5 billion years. It's gone. I don't think any of mankind is going to have to worry about that. I believe Jesus will come back before that ever happens. That's what this lesson's all about. This is just God's creation. It didn't just happen. Couldn't have just happened. God put all of this into place. And again, it's beyond... Well, I say our comprehension, it's beyond my comprehension, I know that. Just the vastness of space, for one. But here is the sun. Something that we just, again, kind of take for granted. Comes up, goes down, it's going to be there. But look at what's going on in that sun to produce what it's producing. Gravity. That's what gas, we're going to look at some solar flares. Part of this, the gravitational pull of the sun is so enormous, it's pulling in on itself. Otherwise, those gases would just go off into space. But the sun is so huge, the gravitational pull is so great that it's keeping it in a ball. Once in a while, part of the sun will escape. And we're going to talk about that in a little bit. It says that the density of the sun is 150 times that of water. If you take water and how dense that is, it's 150 times denser than that in the sun. It is over 200 billion times greater than the atmospheric pressure here on Earth. How much pressure do we have on us at sea level? 15 pounds per square inch at sea level. Of course, if you go in the mountains, you have less. Everything's measured at sea level. 15 pounds of pressure every square inch of your body. The air is pushing in on you. On the sun, that is 200 billion times greater. So you talk about how it keeps it together? Gravity. That's how much pressure there is. It's just like taking some clay and just squeeze it in your hand as tight as you can squeeze it. That is pressure. In the process of producing energy, the sun makes solar flares that are powerful bursts of radiation. Some of you have probably seen pictures where certain parts of the sun just pop out, burst out. The harmful radiation from a solar flare cannot pass through Earth's atmosphere to physically affect humans on the ground because of the Earth's magnetic field. We talked about the magnetic field. That's one of the reasons it's here, to protect us. If it wasn't for the magnetic field, our atmosphere would be gone. However, when intense enough, these flares can disturb the atmosphere in the upper layers where the GPS and communication signals travel, and it can also affect our power grid. That's how powerful they are. This is 93 million miles away, and yet it affects us. There's the magnetic field. We saw this picture earlier. Of course, this is just an artist's rendition of what they think the magnetic field looks like. But this magnetic field, like I said, it's like a force field. If you ever watch some of the Star Trek stuff like that, when they got an enemy ship coming in, what do? Put up the force field! Keep from getting bullet shot at them. Well, that's basically what the magnetic field is for us. It's our force shield. It protects us from the bad elements in space. And again, if we didn't have it, we wouldn't have an atmosphere. It'd be wiped out. How many of you ever played with magnets and iron filings? So this is just a bar magnet. We can't see the lines of the magnetic field. We can see how they affect other metal objects. But if you put these iron filings on a piece of paper or something like that, they line up in line with the fields of the magnetic force. So it kind of gives you an idea. That's the reason that artist's rendition of the Earth, it kind of has an idea of how it works. So most of you have probably done something like this. But this is what it looks like. Well, you got a North Pole and South Pole as we determine it. And if you line up a North Pole and a South Pole, it's going to just line itself up. If you go north and north, what's it do? Repels. You can't get them together. They keep wanting to push each other away, or two South Poles. So this is kind of how a magnetic field works. But we've got one of these magnetic fields around the Earth. And like I said, it's there to protect us from the radiation and other elements that comes from space. Here's another drawing. Kind of shows us the effect. This is the solar wind. Right there. It's pushing toward Earth. The solar wind is a stream of charged particles coming from the sun. It's particles that are being pushed out from the sun toward the Earth. A lot of it's radiation that could be harmful to us. But the magnetic field, as you can see, when it gets there, it kind of pushes all that stuff off to the side. Now, what we do see in the North and South Poles, where it's not quite as strong, we see the Northern Lights, or the Southern Lights, if you're on the Southern Hemisphere. But that is these charged particles interacting with the magnetic field. And they put on quite a display. Some of these guys over here have seen those. I've never seen one. Never been that far north or south. But that is the magnetic field at work, pushing away those charged particles of radiation, keeping us safe. There are eruptive events on the sun, such as solar flares. And they can be widely different in nature. For example, some erupt just as a solar flare, which is kind of just a burst of light. Others come with an additional ejection of solar material called coronal mass ejection. CME is what scientists use for abbreviation. CME. That's part of the sun itself being thrown out in space. And some erupt with the complex moving structures in association with changes in the magnetic field lines that loop up into the sun's outer atmosphere called the corona. So we saw the iron filings, how they kind of shape around. Well, you've got those same magnetic fields up in the sun. They're a lot stronger than what we have here on this Earth. But some of this sun gets trapped up in those magnetic fields, and you can see where the magnetic lines are. On July 19, 2012, which is about 6 years ago, an eruption occurred on the sun that produced all three of these. It was a solar flare. It threw out part of the sun, CMEs, and it also aligned itself with those magnetic lines. And then, it says, a moderately powerful solar flare exploded on the sun and sent out light and radiation. Next came a CME, which is coronal mass ejection. Part of the sun was being shot off out in space. And then the sun treated viewers to one of its dazzling magnetic displays, a phenomenon known as coronal rain. So some of this sun got shot up into space, got up there in the magnetic field, and then it started falling back down to the sun. It looked like rain. And that's what they call it. The next slide contains a video of this solar flare, the one that happened. The footage of this video was collected by the Solar Dynamics Observatory's AIA instrument in July of 2012. Like I said, about 6 years ago. Each second in this video corresponds to 6 minutes of real time. So they've condensed this thing down and will show 21.5 hours of activity in 4 minutes and 15 seconds. So our video is 4 minutes and 15 seconds, but the whole thing lasted 21 and a half hours. We don't have 21 and a half hours to sit here and do that. There is some music going to play with this. This is not sound that came from the sun. This is music by Lars Leonard called Thunderbolt. So that's the music you'll be hearing. This is a medium-sized flare. Mm-hmm.
Do what? This is it's 21 and a half hours condensed into 4 minutes and 15 seconds. So again, the sun is huge, so it's kind of hard to tell exactly how big this flare is. So then what they do, they show you the size of the Earth. So the flare is huge. But you can see that it's being shot up, and as it comes down, it's in these curves, so that's following that, the magnetic field. So there are smaller eruptions, there are larger eruptions. Again, this is what they call a medium-sized one. But this one probably may not cause as much trouble as some other ones, because it got shot up and then it's being brought back down on itself instead of just being shot straight out in space and going out through space itself. The lower right over there, you see another solar flare that's kind of working, but it's nothing like the one we're seeing here. But you see the material falling back down to the sun. That's what they call the corona ray. Those light patches are going to be pretty hot. The dark areas that you see is, like I said, probably 6,000 to 11,000 degrees Fahrenheit. No, it's particles. Yeah. Like I said, the gravitational pull on the sun is enormous. So in order for something to escape the sun like that, it really has to be shot off pretty fast or not pull it back in. Yep. Right. Yeah, this is all gases. And that one down on the bottom right, you know, it's kind of acting up a little bit. You see some of the flames coming up, but it's not ejecting up like this one. Just click on that slide up there on the screen. There you go. Okay, this next slide is a GIF. And if you've worked with computers and images, you know what a GIF is. But a GIF is basically graphics interchange format. And what that means, you know, we just saw a video that was reduced from 21 and a half hours down to 4 minutes. And what they did, they just chopped out part of the film. And a GIF, you don't chop out anything. You just condense the data down to make it really small. Especially the older computers, you know, memory and stuff was very valuable. So you wanted to be able to transfer stuff without taking a lot of space. But you didn't want to degrade the quality of your pictures. So they came up with a GIF. And so this next one is a GIF. And generally what happens is they show you a part of a video and then it repeats itself. Just repeat itself. This happened in September of 2017, which is what? About a year ago. The solar flare had interesting effects here on Earth. It knocked out the high-frequency radio, according to NOAA, and degraded low-frequency navigation. There they got the sun blotted out so they can just see the corona part of the sun. But look how that thing
fuse out. And this stuff is not coming back to the sun. It's going out. This is what causes us big problems. Because it affects, like I said, communications, GPS. Also, a lot of electronics and our electric grid. This interacts with our magnetic field, but it's really disrupting the magnetic field here on Earth. And so our communications up in the upper atmosphere, where a lot of our transmission takes place, it can just wipe it out. You may have heard sometimes when they talk about, they anticipate one of these things, or they see one coming, you know, it takes it a while for it to get here, they can know that it's going to happen. But anyway, this kind of gives you just an idea of this thing jetting out in space. And one of the things is you notice it just comes out one part of the sun. So not all the sun's looking at us. There's just a one little section that's, you know, pointing our direction right at Earth. So if it's being ejected off to this side or that side or someplace else, it's not really affecting us. But if it's pointing toward the direction of Earth, one of these things, again, it can wipe out communications and electronics. And it could possibly even wipe out our electric grid or cause a lot of problems. Yeah, the sun is kind of on a cycle for the most part, 11-year cycle. For about 11 years, you'll have a lot of this activity. Then about 11 years, it'll calm down. Then 11 years, it builds back up again. So yeah, it kind of goes in cycles. Of course, like anything else, it's not always just exact dates, but it does kind of go in those group of cycles. Okay, we're going to end there. We'll have class again next week, and then the following week will be our singing. We're going to continue talking about our sun for a little bit. And then we'll talk about the earth and moon, and then we'll continue on from there. But we've still got a few more things to talk about our sun. But we've seen tonight that our sun, it's just amazing. There's a lot of activity going on. There's a lot of things that we don't know about. You know, we're just learning some of these things. And one of the problems with the sun, for one, it's a long ways away. And two, it is so hot and bright, it's hard to do a lot of research. It's hard to send up a satellite to the sun. But did you know that we just sent one to the sun? On August the 12th, Sunday, August the 12th. Now, when was that? About 2.5 weeks ago. We sent a probe. We're going to the sun. We're going to get within 3.8 million miles of the sun. It's 93 million miles away. So we're going to get within 4% of that distance to the sun. But we'll talk about that next week. Yeah. So we'll talk more about this next week. But one of the things that scientists really wanted to do is, of course, send a probe to the sun. But how hot is it? Just the surface is 6,000 to 11,000 degrees Fahrenheit. It's hard to put anything too close. But technology has kind of caught up a little bit, and we're able to produce some heat shields that can protect it pretty good. So that's what they're doing. This thing got, like I said, launched off 2.5 weeks ago. It's going to rendezvous with Venus on October the 3rd. When it hits Venus, of course, you probably heard that when they do probes and stuff to send them out in space, they'll send them to, like, Venus or Mars, let them get into the gravitational pull of that planet, and then shoot them off. It's kind of like a slingshot effect. That's what they're going to do with this probe. And then it's going to go ahead and head to the sun, and its first close rendezvous with the sun will be November the 5th of this year. So it's going to be there pretty close. It's a 7-year mission. It's going to circle the Earth or the sun 24 times, and each time, matter of fact, it's going to go to the sun, circle the sun, kind of come back out, hit Venus again, and get slung back in even further to where eventually we'll reach that 3.8 million mile distance from the sun. Pretty neat. And to me, it's just amazing that these guys had the technology and the brains to do that kind of stuff. You know, I'd have no idea how to do any of that. But we got some smart people that are doing that.